By way of introduction, I have to declare myself a true believer in the transformative power of beauty, especially the beauty of human performance. The arts, and especially opera that tells us universal stories about the human condition, have the power to deepen our understanding of ourselves and other people more fully. In so doing, the arts increase our capacity for empathy. Max Stevenson argues that democracy requires that its voters possess a measure of empathetic imagination, as this facility ultimately allows individuals to dignify others in society beyond families and specific kinship networks. In his Republic, the philosopher Plato, and in this community I have to be careful not to suggest Plato Carayannis, in the Republic, Plato says, "Music is most sovereign because rhythm and harmony find their way to the inmost soul and take strongest hold upon it, imparting grace." So the arts, music, opera, they make us better people and they make us stronger in our communities. Opera America is the umbrella organization for the entire opera industry. We are an action-oriented think tank where we draw on the collective experience and expertise of our members to derive benefit for the entire field. We try to perceive what the issues are that must be addressed in opera to make it stronger, and we plan courses of action to respond to those issues. We facilitate the sharing of resources so that opera companies can devote as much time and effort as possible to putting on productions for appreciative audiences. We don't want to waste time solving problems that have been solved elsewhere or inventing resources that already exist. We support experimentation, research, and documentation and distribution of findings. And we are one of service organizations that populate all the disciplines, like the League of American Orchestras, Theater Communications Group, Chamber Music America. All of us from time to time work on projects that strengthen the entire fabric of the arts in this country. And one of those national service organizations is centered here in San Antonio, the National Association of Latino Arts and Culture. NALAC is right here in this town. Opera America was established in 1970 by 17 opera companies, and they were mid-sized opera companies that all owned sets and costumes, but no one knew what anyone had in any of their other warehouses. They wanted to rent them from one another or exchange or borrow them. So Opera America was established as a kind of co-production collaborative that enabled people to co-produce and build more and better operas. Since that time, we've grown to include about 135 opera companies across the United States, over 100 university opera programs and conservatories, another 100 or so smaller opera ensembles. We have all the service providers and consultants to the field of opera as our members, as well as thousands of artists and individual trustees, patrons, and opera lovers. We established Opera .ca in Toronto about 15 years ago, and at about the same time we established Opera Europa in Brussels that now serves 135 opera companies in 25 countries. We have a quarterly magazine and lots of resources on our website that you might find of interest. We have an equal commitment to supporting the creation, production, and enjoyment of opera. To that end, we have awarded over $12 million in the last 25 years, to support the creation and production of new American operas. We've just started a new program to support female composers, because amazingly, of all of our grants in that $12 million, only 5% went to female composers. So we now have a new program that will identify and support the work exclusively of female American opera composers. We support singers with feedback auditions, recording days, and professional development seminars. And as Jody mentioned, we have the Director-Designer Showcase that is named in honor of Robert L.B. Tobin that every other year recognizes four outstanding director-designer teams. And I can say that as a result of our program, these teams have gone on individually and together to significant career progress. We have a textbook series called Music Words Opera that empowers the classroom teacher to teach the arts through opera. We also have an adult learning program, and we'll be launching a few MOOCs. We can talk more about that afterward in the fall. To advance all of these goals, again, as Jody mentioned, we built the National Opera Center. It opened in September of 2012. We have a recital hall, recording studio, rehearsal halls, vocal studios, so that all of the artists who are in New York have a home, an industry home in New York, and all of the producers and directors who travel to New York from around the country are able to do their essential work in a custom-built facility. In our first year alone, we had over 30,000 people sign in at the Opera Center, and we're expecting more than 50,000 this year in our second year. We also keep an office in Washington, D.C., for our advocacy. We try to represent you to the best of our ability in the issues of arts education, the deductibility of charitable gifts to cultural organizations, cultural exchange, especially as it applies to non-immigrant artists, and certainly the National Endowment for the Arts. We believe that the arts should be a part of the federal agenda. And as Don Randall said, Don was the former president of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. He said, the main contribution of the arts in our country to the national defense is to make the country worth defending. Well, we certainly agree with Don. So what is opera? Opera is the only art form to have been invented. You know, dance occurs naturally. People started playing reeds and blowing on blades of grass to make instruments and beating on hollow logs. Opera was actually invented by a group of people in 1597 in Florence. And the first opera by Jacopo Peri, Daphne, was attributed to 1597. It's a score that's lost. But the Florentines and all the Italians were discovering, rediscovering ancient culture. They were digging up ruins and urns and vases and chariots out of the land around them, and they became fascinated with understanding classical culture. And they came to learn that theater in Greece was somehow sung. There was a chorus. Lines were declaimed, and they were trying to recreate, as they were restoring antiquities, they tried to recreate what they thought this Greek drama was, and it led to opera. For the last 400 years, we've seen a cycle of experimentation, of opera styles changing from grand to more intimate, from elaborate to more simple, from chamber scale to the supranational opera of the 19th century. It's being rebalanced today with a healthier mix now between grand opera and chamber scale opera, largely a part of economics, but also part of aesthetics, as people prefer a more intimate art form than the huge grand opera of the 19th century. This is a return to what Vikram Seth refers to as a more natural scale of music in his book, An Equal Music, written in 2000. What is opera? I took a look at what Donald Grout says in A Brief History of Opera, a book that is anything but brief. When we were at college, we used to refer to it not as grout, but grunt, and perhaps some of you did as well. What is an opera, he says? It's a drama in music, a dramatic action exhibited on a stage with scenery by actors in costume, the words conveyed for the most part by singing, and the whole sustained by orchestral music. Neither the poetry nor the music of an opera is to be judged as if it exists by itself. In actuality, they are united as the elements of hydrogen and oxygen are united in water. But to be a little bit more passionate about it, I turn to Peter Conrad in his book, Opera, The Song of Love and Death. He says, opera is a mystery. Like a religion, it changes the lives of those it wins over. Opera has this potency because it treats aspects of experience no other art has the boldness to address. It is the song of our irrationality, of the instinctual savagery which our jobs and routines and our non-singing voices belie, of the music our bodies make. The characters of opera obey neither moral nor social law. What rises in and overflows from the orchestra pit is the geyser of their desires. They give voice to the promptings of the underground consciousness. Living subliminally, people in opera are proud to be amoral. Some of opera's most psychologically thrilling moments are refusals to repent. Now, opera in the United States has a storied history. The first operas performed in the United States were performed by French colonists in New Orleans. The next operas to be recorded were performed in Philadelphia, and actually it was in 1776 that the first American written opera was performed in Philadelphia. It's called The Disappointment and is not to be mistaken as a commentary on the art form itself. There isn't a whole history of opera in Boston. The Puritans frowned on Boston then, and some would suggest they still do. There is a wonderful rich tradition of touring opera in the United States. In the 19th century, Lorenzo de Ponte was the librettist for Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, Così fan tutte and Don Giovanni. And he was thrown out of Europe, out of London in 1799, and he came to New York, and he set up a grocery store in New Jersey. He founded the Italian department at Columbia University, and he brought an Italian opera troupe touring through the New England area. So some early performances of Mozart were actually produced tours in the United States by the librettist himself of Mozart's three most famous operas. The oldest opera company in the United States that's still functioning continuously is the Metropolitan Opera, established in 1883. The second oldest company after that is Cincinnati Opera, established in 1920, and after that the San Francisco Opera. The real explosion of the formation of opera companies occurs after World War II. Most of the opera companies in our country are still younger than 70 years, but the great companies, for instance, of Chicago and Santa Fe and Houston, all established after World War II, and even more recently than Dallas, Austin, Amarillo, and San Antonio. Opera composition in the United States was slow to get going. The first premiere at the Metropolitan Opera was in 1910. It had already been around for 27 years, and it was under the leadership of the general director, Giulio Gatti-Casazza, that the Metropolitan Opera made a real commitment to new opera. The first new opera, though, was by Puccini. It was The Girl of the Golden West by the play of David Belasco. But after that, there were, through the 20s particularly, works by Walter Damrosch, Charles Wakefield Cadman, Victor Herbert, Deems Taylor, Louis Grunberg, Howard Hanson. The flow of American operas would have been made more interesting. The Met had commissioned Gershwin for another opera after Porgy and Bess, but Gershwin died before he fulfilled that commission. And then came the Depression and World War II. Then came radio and recordings, so that the entire economy of opera changed, and we didn't see a flourishing of new American opera until we get to the 1950s. And by the time we get to the 1950s, we see Carlyle Floyd's Susanna, Douglas Moore's The Ballad of Baby Doe, Samuel Barber's Vanessa, an opera that was actually commissioned for Maria Callas, but she never performed it. She pulled out of it. Today, there is a flood of new American opera, telling American stories based on American politics, American movies, and American literature. Important new works today by Jake Heggie, his Moby Dick, or Silent Night by Kevin Putz. Works by Mark Adamo, Ricky Ian Gordon, Osvaldo Golahoff, and your own Tobias Picker. A younger generation now taking up the mantle, David T. Little, Paola Prestini, Missy Mazzoli. A wonderful, wonderful group of artists who want to express themselves through opera. The trends defy categorization. Traditional grand opera in a modern idiom, chamber opera in various styles, site-specific operas that are created for particular locations where they're being performed, even staged oratorios, staged performances of the St. Matthew Passion or of Handel's oratorios, staged song cycles from 19th century song cycles to new ones. There has been in recent years a wonderful exploration of Baroque opera, and more recently, the exploration of operas of Central Eastern Europe, Szymanowski, Janáček, and Dvorak, as we'll see tomorrow night here. So why opera matters is, of course, the name of the presentation. It's an argument that has to be made frequently. There is the perception of opera being a European art form of the 19th century that is old, long, boring, irrelevant. There's a perception of opera as being very, very expensive. And in certain ways, this is true. George Bernard Shaw said that opera was the second most expensive invention of man, second only to war. it doesn't necessarily mean that the tickets have to be expensive, but the production of opera is very expensive. The perception of opera as being popular by popular among an older, wealthy patronage. Now, let me assure you that after having seen Anna Nicole and Two Boys in New York, the opera house, for the right programming at the right price, will be filled with young people. But at the same time, perhaps because of the strength of these perceptions or misperceptions, opera is a cultural touchstone in contemporary culture, sometimes appreciatively and sometimes derisively. The Marx Brothers, A Night at the Opera, Moonstruck, Pretty Woman, commercials for luxury products or for Rice Krispies, cartoons, sports events from the World Cup, remember the three tenors, to this Sunday's Super Bowl, where Renee Fleming has gotten so much press for singing the Star-Spangled Banner, the first opera singer to sing the Star-Spangled Banner at a Super Bowl. Opera is simultaneously the most alluring and off-putting of forms. Sprawling, complex, intense, demanding, thrilling, opera is seen by some to be the ultimate evening out and by others to be the ultimate punishment. It all depends. Why does this originally, but no longer 19th century European art form, attract us so much? Number one, and I have 10 reasons. Number one, opera reflects and responds to the human need to tell stories and to extend those stories with music and dance. It is a need that people have as long as people have been walking on earth, from Native Americans to Africans to Aboriginal Australians. Everyone tells stories, and they extend those stories. They amplify those stories with music, singing, and dance. Opera, per se, was invented in 1597, but the notion of this mixture of text, music, and image is as old as we are. What's wonderful about the storytelling of opera is that the words tell the story while the music tell the emotions. It is a double-layered storytelling. The consonants give meaning, the vowels give emotion. And the fact that those two threads exist simultaneously makes opera a unique way to tell universal stories. Number two, within the framework of traditional storytelling, opera transmits shared values and norms. Opera enables us to explore the human psyche at the edge of sanity. The emotions of love and desire, jealousy, rage, all of them are portrayed in opera in archetypical dimension. They are larger than life. They are amplified emotions. And we, as audience, get to explore the range of human emotions beyond what is allowable in general society. We get to feel the release of living life as if we didn't have restraint, as if in response to heartbreak we did kill ourselves or jump off a parapet or poison our rival. We all wish we could or would or should, but we don't. We go to the opera house and we get to watch what happens when people forget about the boundary between sanity and insanity. And we then have to watch them live with the consequences of their lack of restraint. Because all of these opera characters who live at the edge of sanity pay the consequences of living at the edge of sanity. And in terms of watching the stories and watching the consequences, we transmit essential human values. Number three. The arts in general, and opera in particular, offer a way to understand history and the world around us. We can understand the world around us through many lenses. Histories have been written, and every day the New York Times is written through the lens of economics or politics, warfare, or religion. But the arts are another way to understand the world based on the creative expression of man's understanding of the world around him. We are a non-destructive, a non-competitive way to understand the world, a constructive approach to history that explores our collective ability to express ourselves and explores the technology that we use to do that. Think of some of the examples of how we learned about Mozart's craving for equality in a class-defined society of the late 18th century, as portrayed in The Marriage of Figaro. Or Beethoven in Fidelio and his quest for individual liberty from under the yoke of tyranny. Verdi and his quest for national identity and independence expressed through Nabucco, or the tribulation, the trauma of the death penalty as explored by Jake Heggie in Dead Man Walking. Opera entertains and it illuminates. It entertains and it explains our world in a way that is different from the other lenses, but equally viable. Number four, the arts in general, including opera, are civic events that strengthen the fabric of our community. And I recommend a book called Alone Together by Sherry Turkle, a professor at MIT. And she goes on to explain how new technology enables us to isolate ourselves. We can stay home alone and watch an array of movies or cultural events on YouTube. We can not answer our cell phone, of course, because we can see who's calling. We can choose not to respond to texts or to emails. We can isolate ourselves and live alone, even though we are together in a community. But this isolation from one another can undermine the civic fabric. It undermines that empathy that is developed when people come together. The arts bring us together. The arts lure us out of our isolation and ask us to come together and sit in rows like this, elbow to elbow. They amplify the intensity of human emotion because all of us are receiving and responding to the emotion in the same room at the same time. These emotional reactions that we share as a community then make us understand one another better over divides of age, gender, ethnicity, or affluence. The Greeks understood this when they invented theater and built their first theater facilities. We're doing it still today, 2,500 years later. And the arts are very important for this communal experience of universal human stories. And none of those stories is more potent, of course, than opera. Number five, opera demands the most from an audience. Many of our wonderful entertainments today invite us to be passive. They don't ask much of us. Television and film as prime examples really just ask us to be comfortable and sit quietly. Opera is demanding. It's complex. You have to pay attention again to all of the basic elements of it, images, words, and music. It requires close attention and emotional participation. Opera rewards the listener for every minute they spend learning more about the text or the composer or the librettist or the language. It forces us to manage a complex sensory flow of multimedia. Multimedia of opera is one of the bridges to younger audiences, and it is one of those challenges that we have to master when we go to the opera house to take in all the layers on which the opera functions, musically and emotionally, scenically, linguistically. Number six, opera is a tremendous educational tool for children. You know, creativity and communication skills are essential in today's workplace. Arts education provides the expressiveness and the confidence that young people need to succeed in a very competitive workforce. Opera offers an exceptional educational opportunity. A teacher can teach various arts, design, drama, literature, music, all together through opera. But opera can also be integrated into the so-called core curriculum better than any of the other art forms. Students can learn about the life of the composer and librettist, learn about the source material in literature or history, learn about the circumstances of the commission of the opera. Students can learn what is the relationship between Verdi's Aida and the construction of the Suez Canal. Why were the costumes delayed in Paris? Because of the Franco-Prussian War. Why was Il Trittico of Puccini premiered at the Metropolitan Opera rather than at La Scala? Well, that was World War I. There are so many connections that can be made linguistically, historically, musically, of course, dramatically through opera. David Storkton is the president of Cornell University. And in an article that just came across my desk, he said, "Training in the arts prepares a growing child just as well for a scientific or technical career as does training in STEM subjects." if not better, STEM subjects being science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So training in the arts prepares a growing child just as well for a scientific or technical career as does training in STEM subjects, if not better. He goes on, to be truly effective, what we really need is a much broader humanistic education for scientists and non-scientists, beginning in K-12 education and continuing through undergraduate, graduate, and professional years. It is through the study of art, music, literature, history, and other humanities and social sciences that we gain a greater understanding of the human condition than biological or physical science alone can provide. Again, he says, it is through the study of art, music, literature, and history. What he's saying is it's through the study of opera. Number 7, opera contributes to the vitality of communities. Let's think about economics. Arts jobs are jobs. Hundreds every night in the opera house, thousands every year at opera companies. So just in and of themselves, the arts are a driver of economic prosperity. I learned a lot. John Hickenlooper is currently the governor of Colorado. When he was the mayor of Denver, I worked with him on a big project. And John Hickenlooper is a huge art supporter, not because he's an artist, but because he's a restaurateur. And he knew in Denver that when his 12 restaurants were full, it was because the Denver Center for the Performing Arts was filled with audiences and performances. He became a huge supporter of the arts because he saw what they did to his restaurants. Let's look at urban renewal. In New York, the Upper West Side was transformed by Lincoln Center. The Lower East Side by artists, musicians, their galleries and clubs. Then they moved to Williamsburg once the Lower East Side became too chic. Well, not too chic, just too expensive. Now, if you are familiar with New York, after Williamsburg, which has been priced out for the artists, they've now moved to Bushwick, which is filled with galleries and restaurants and all of the artists who are living in Bushwick, which is where my Italian immigrant family lived in 1900. I had sometimes thought about going back to Bushwick when I was an adult, but it was always too sketchy a neighborhood until now it's filled with galleries and restaurants. The High Line Park in New York completely transformed the meatpacking district. These are the arts generating urban development. In Los Angeles, downtown LA is being defined by the arts, the Music Center, Disney Hall, the new Broad Museum that's being built, the Coburn School, the Museum of Contemporary Art. In Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust that owns and operates the cultural venues in downtown Pittsburgh have made sure that that old industrial city turns the corner to a newfound prosperity. And in San Antonio, I remember my tour in December of the new Tobin Performing Arts Center with Bruce Bug. The Tobin Center will open up yet another area of downtown to further development. The arts are an engine for strong communities. The presence of arts organizations, opera companies in particular, in my view, is that corporations want to relocate there because they find that these cities with arts are good places to live, are good places where they can attract employees who can work for the corporations. Arts are good for the city. The arts demonstrate the highest possible level of collaboration. Collaboration in opera begins with that fundamental partnership between words and music. Then think about what goes on stage. Collaboration between highly trained, highly talented, highly opinionated professionals, conductors, directors, designers, and singers, orchestral musicians and choristers, backstage staff and front-of-house staff, artists and administrators, administrators and trustees, trustees and donors. We can keep on going. It's all collaboration. Collaboration between organizations, between opera companies and symphonies, exemplified here in San Antonio, between opera companies and dance companies when they need ballet in the opera, between opera companies and the venues in which they perform. Despite the fact that hundreds of people are involved in every opera performance around the country, opera curtains go up on time every night. I wish airlines could be as dependable. I wish Congress were as productive. Number 9. Opera is a demonstration of the perfectibility of the human instrument. In opera, the body is the instrument. Singers don't carry around violins and cellos or flutes. They don't have to sit down at a piano. Their body is their instrument. A successful career in opera results from a dedicated life, dedicated to discipline, study, practice, and perfection. Not only perfection, but also protection, because the body, the instrument, must be safeguarded. I think when people look on stage and see other people like them who have trained and harnessed and disciplined their breath and the coordination of their muscles to make a sound that fills a hall, it's a magical extension of what each of us has, but few of us have perfected. Like many sports, of course, these sports stars train their bodies the same way that opera singers do, but the sports stars are done by the age of 30. Opera singers will sing until they're 50 or 60. It's a life of dedication. The tonal quality that emerges from a body is an identifier, is the sound of the resonance of my insides. As you sit and look at a singer and listen to a singer, you have an intimate connection with them that is unlike any other kind of intimacy. You're listening to the resonance of their body. And sometimes those bodies aren't slender and beautiful according to traditional standards. Carolyn Abate, in her book, A History of Opera, in contradistinction to a brief history of opera, but her history of opera is as long as the brief history of opera, she says, opera alone can trade in imperfect faces and unfashionable forms, such offenses against our visual expectations being overlooked or even celebrated in the world of singing. Our contemporary culture, so dominated by the visual, and in which a particular image of physical perfection is so obsessively valued, is among the most important of the wrong bodily shapes. Today's opera houses are places where the look of a character is rarely dominant. In that sense, opera may provide a space in which we can appreciate an alternative and valuable truth. It's one of my favorite quotes. Number 10, opera is a multimedia art form that resonates with the multimedia world we live in. As I said before, opera was the first multimedia art form invented in 1597. It took the rest of the world 400 years to catch up with us. This multimedia intensity, of course, is a great bridge to younger audiences who have grown up expecting to have multimedia entertainment as the basis for engagement. But opera does not only employ this technology. Opera, in many parts of history, has optimized new technology. Whether it's theater lighting in the 19th century, tested and perfected in the opera house, whether it's new musical instruments in the orchestra pit, the trombone, saxophone, and others. Opera has been a place where technology is embraced, and in fact where the technology is optimized. The recording industry. The recording industry had its killer app early in the 20th century. There was Puccini, Caruso, and RCA Victor. Who knows what would have happened to RCA Victor if it hadn't had opera in the form of Puccini and Caruso. What a wonderful use of radio that in the 1930s, performances on a weekly basis were broadcast live from the Metropolitan Opera as they are today. We're beginning to close in on the century mark there. Radio was optimized with its use for opera broadcasts. The same can be said for telecasts. How has the television been used in a richer way than to transmit opera? The internet and live streaming. In the early years of this century, I had phone calls from more venture capitalists who wanted to try to create online opera channels because opera was the most incredible potential use of broadband. All of this wonderful sound, the images, movement on the screen, HD transmissions, really perfected by the Metropolitan Opera, and yes, other art forms are using the HD transmissions, but none as effectively as opera. It's a perfect use of the big screen and the sound system. Whenever there is a new technology, opera not only employs it, but opera in many ways optimizes that technology. So, in conclusion, an opera company in your community provides a range of creative, educational, and economic benefits. The work of opera artists help to build civic unity and cross-cultural understanding. The presence of an opera company, along with other arts organizations, demonstrates that your community is established and successful. It suggests that you have the human talent and the physical facilities characteristic of a major city. It suggests the presence of an audience that is educated, curious, and outgoing. An opera company demonstrates that the community values philanthropy, that citizens are prepared to make the contributions necessary to support a high quality of life. For a community, an opera company represents a level of cultural attainment, not because opera is better than any other art form, but because it represents a community's depth of resources and its ability to organize them. Opera demonstrates that you believe in living healthy, in healthy living. I was just going through some papers to prepare for another meeting, and I remembered this from my, seventh grade health class back in junior high school. The World Health Organization in 1946 approved a definition of health. It was approved by 61 countries. It entered into force in 1948, and it has never been amended since 1948. It says, health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. Not merely the absence of disease or infirmity, but complete physical, mental, and social well-being. And the arts and opera are responsible for a significant part of that physical, mental, and social well-being. So you, in having an opera company here in San Antonio, have made a commitment to being a leading city and a healthy community. So I really do want to congratulate all of the city leaders who have made the Tobin Arts Center come into fruition. I had a hard hat tour of it in December, as I say, and it's going to be a magnificent facility. I want to congratulate all of the leaders who are putting together a first-class opera company to go into that new performing arts center, San Antonio Opera. I also want to congratulate everyone involved with tomorrow evening's performance of Rusalka, which I hear is going to be a really splendid musical evening, and I think there's a second performance on Saturday. But if you haven't gotten your tickets, I suggest you do so. And above all, I would really like to thank the McNay for inviting me to tell you why opera means a lot to me, why I hope it means a lot to you, and if you agree, that you'll share the word about why the arts and opera in particular matter in this community. Thank you so very much. Thank you.